Ladies and gentlemen, Greg Proops!
The smartest man in the world, Proopcast, takes to the ether from the gigantic, commodious confines of the Hearst Forum here at the Academy of Sciences at San Francisco's inestimable, indescribably beautiful Golden Gate Park, ladies and gentlemen. It's so very exciting to be here in what can only be described as a giant rectangle. Apparently, they give lectures on sea life here and then administer a spanking machine afterward, from what I can tell for the room. There is a window behind me here, but we can't have it open because apparently gigantic security lights shine in the whole time and will burn holes in your retina. I welcome you to the show, and I have to say, I feel like an eight-year-old, not in a Penn State way, but I feel like an eight-year-old. Walk it off, bitches. Walk it off. I feel like an eight-year-old because I grew up in here, really. I mean, I'm from San Carlos, California, originally. Exactly. Two people, the rest of you, really? That's all right. Some of you are probably from San Leandro, so yeah, I know how it feels. San Carlos is a small white principality, some 30 minutes and 10 years south of here. And we were driven up here all the time to come to the Academy of Sciences, the old WPA Academy of Sciences, before they revamped it all. It's so beautiful now. There's carpet, and it doesn't smell bad, and nothing's falling off the walls. And we were dragged up here every bloody weekend. San Francisco Zoo or Flash Hacker Zoo. I don't know if it's even still called that. And up here to the Academy of Sciences. My next-door neighbor in the apartment building I lived in San Carlos was a young boy named Thomas March, and we were just kids. And his mother was named Candy, like this song by Cameo. It's like candy. And except her husband didn't wear a red codpiece. And March would drive us up here, and she was Scottish. I don't know how to describe it. She was Scottish as fuck, okay? like she talked like that, and she called us Wayans. Wayans. W-E apostrophe E. U-N, is it? S? That's how Scottish people call. That's Weans. Weans. The little ones. Wayans. Wayans. Yeah. I don't know how they got it out of Wayans, but they did. How they got Weans into Wayans. She'd go, her husband Hal was Canadian, and he'd go, hey, Candy, how'd it go with the kids today, right? And she'd go, I think you. She had a bloody loud personality. I took the Wayans out of the museum. And we saw the whale skeleton. And there's a giant whale skeleton here, which I couldn't have been more excited about, because when I was little, it was outside in a weird outbuilding, not in the museum. It was in a little, like, three-quarter, like, Indian sweat lodge, you know, like where the Ohlones would beat one another or whatever. It was a... It had a roof, but not three, no walls, just a chicken wire fence, and the whale skeleton just hung out there for as long as I can remember. They must have just moved it in here recently. It was behind Shakespeare Gardens. I don't know if anyone ever has gone to Shakespeare Gardens here in Golden Gate Park. Me and my buddy Mike McShane did the Shakespeare Festival here, the San Francisco Shakespeare Festival, in like, 1945. We had just shown Jerry a thing or two, and... that's what we called the Germans during the war. And we used to do, it was in like 86, I guess. And we used to smoke joints in Shakespeare's Garden and then read the poetry very badly while falling over laughing. And the whale skeleton was right behind there. And then we go look at it. So literally, I've been like an eight-year-old all night, except this is an accelerated, amped up part of being an eight-year-old. They didn't serve vodka in this place. There's full bars all over this museum tonight, which is, I think, the most... stunning improvement I've ever seen. If learning had been this fun when I was young, if they'd had like a Kool-Aid stop with like lemon cookies every 13 feet in those days, no one ever drank bottled water when I was little. You had a Coca-Cola, so that by the end of the day you were insane. If they'd had vodka when I was old enough, and now they're selling vodka here at night. They have nighttime events. It's fantastic. So many of the exhibits I recognize from when I was little, and that unbelievable aquarium where from the top you can look down and there's a railing made of seahorses in the style of seahorses. That's been there for ages. I'm guessing that's from whenever this was built in the 20s or 30s. And but what were the brothers' names? Ignaz and Sigmund Steinhardt. Ignaz. You meet a Dwayne every once in a while. You might even meet a Frederick occasionally. But Ignaz is a name that has gone the way of Leopold. Yeah, there's not a lot of Ignaz walking around anymore. Ignaz gave the money for this fabulous place. And inside, below that that enclosure where all the seahorses are, is the most disgusting albino American alligator I have ever... Absolutely mortifying. If you want to be reminded of what it was like 3.5 million years ago, when we were just tiny 3.5 foot tall, hairy little hunchy apes with sloping brows who could barely make fire and just rutted from behind and then did very poor reenactments around the fire because we hadn't fucking figured out Flint yet. The idea of an albino alligator sends shockwaves down my spine. You talk about primal fear. There's nothing like a shark or an alligator with their weird, dead, fucking horrible doll eyes looking at you. And the albino alligator, first of all, alligators are smart. They're canny. Reptiles aren't as dumb as everyone thinks. They have personalities. As the hunter says in Jurassic Park the first, they land. I was in Florida a couple years ago at a place called Marcos Island, and I was being driven to do the morning radio show, and the guy was saying, see that path over there? Joggers get attacked by crocodiles and alligators there. And I said, while they're jogging? And he goes, yeah, because they take the same path every day. Took you a minute, but you got there, didn't you? The alligators wait by the side of the path and go, oh, 8:15, here comes that chick. And then one morning they're like, you know what? Fuck it. I want some yuppie girl. That's what I want. And they'll eat you. And they were stalking and eating people off that path there. So one, they learn. Two, if you're ever face to face with an alligator in the wild, freak out, because I don't know what you'd do, really. People go like, oh, try to be bigger than an animal. I don't think reptiles are impressed by that mammal gambit. If you see a mountain lion and you go, a mountain lion might go, what the fuck? Really? You're acting big? All right, I'm going to go. This is an egregious breach of mammal etiquette. I am a predator. You are but a naked, weird, fucking furless piece of shit that smells weird, wearing some kind of cologne, and I think that's garlic? And they flip out. But I think reptiles are like, yeah, be as big as you want. I'm going to eat your ankle first. Alligators can run, what is it, like 25 miles an hour over a short burst? And in a 100-yard dash, you would not beat a reptile. That's all I'm saying. So that tank always scares the living daylights out of me, and therefore unmissable. There's also electric eels in the aquarium, and there's a little sign next to the tank. And, of course, eels' eyes. There's a moray eel here, too. Nothing is more terrifying than fucking moray eels because they've got that weird undertone going against it. And then their eyes are heinous, right? Their eyes don't even have pupils. They're like, and you know if a moray eel gets a hold of your leg or your hand, that's the enchilada. It's over. You know, good night, nurse. Victory eel time is what that is. And the electric eels are equally as shocking and to look at. There's a little display next to it that says, put your hand on the brass thing to feel like what it is to get a shock from a moray eel. I'm with my wife. I've had a couple vodkas. I go, I'm going to do it. And I put my hand on it. That's why my hair looks like young Einstein from that horrible 80s movie. Because it is a lot of electricity. 650 volts they can deliver, which is enough to, I think, start a Republican candidate's heart. The albino alligator, the more eel, the electric eel. There's also a planetarium here, and I don't know if you've been to the Morrison Planetarium. Was it always in this building? Wasn't it? Didn't it used to be in a separate building? Or was it always in this one? Everyone's shaking their heads both yes and no. I love the Bay Area. What I'd like is a little more aggressiveness with my passive aggressiveness. This is the only place in the world where people come. There's a giant Africa hall here, and there's stuffed giraffes and elephants and rhinos, and people in the Bay Area come and go, oh. Those animals were killed like a million years ago, you guys. That giraffe wasn't freshly killed like this morning in Belmont. Get over your fucking selves. Unbelievable. People look at the little giraffe. Oh, little giraffe. That giraffe was killed in like 1898. You weren't going to be able to save it, okay? No amount of time travel, no amount of fucking wishful thinking, no amount of playing Angry Birds or whatever is going to allow you to go back in time and save that tiny giraffe's life. So just enjoy it. Enjoy the weird stuffed tiny giraffe. There's an entire African hall here, and we would spend forever when I was little going through it because gigantic elephants in a case. They like shot elephants, brought them, or maybe they shot them here. Maybe you're right. Maybe they were domestically raised, and those elephants are from Alameda or Stockton or something. You know, the elephants of the Sacramento River are one of the forgotten elephants. Over in Vallejo trying to score meth. I'm fucked to the tits. An astounding amount of stuffed or taxidermy, is it? Animals, including there used to be, I haven't been in there yet because I'm going to go in after. There used to be awesomely. A weasel stalking a bird in one of the displays. I don't know if that one's still there. And everyone here will just nod their head both yes and no at the same time. The planetarium, my recollection was the planetarium was in Golden Gate Park, but not in this exact building. Like it was in a building adjacent. Because they had a thing in the 70s when I was in high school called the 1870s, Greg? Yeah. Right about when that giraffe got shot. I'm sure they didn't shoot the giraffe. I'm sure they just tricked it until it panicked and had a heart attack. See, that's how sensitive you fuckers are. Everybody here went, you shouldn't trick baby giraffes into my heart. That's cruel. In the 70s, we used to drive up from San Carlos in my Dodge Colt. That was yellow and had an insanely weak U-joint. So that the car went like this the whole time. And I got like two FM stations. And we would drive up and get high. Duh. And go to the planetarium. And they had a thing called Laserium. And that was so down by law then. This is way before we had interactive phones and every manner of gee-gaw and device. And we didn't have gaming then. We had, I think it was the very dawn of Pong. And there was another game called Space Race that we used to go down to Stanford to the coffee house and play there all night long. And, you know, if you remember Pong, it went boop. And then the ball went across like this. And then another paddle came up on the other side and went. That was it. And then the ball went back across. That fast. I'm doing it faster than it went. I'm giving you the most frantic Pong match of all time. Boop. Boop. And the paddles only went up and down. They didn't go side to side, man. And that was considered inconceivable high tech in those days. So Laserium was, I think, some stoned IT guy of the 70s at the helm of this, like, battery of lasers, right? And they can make them different colors, and they can make them different shapes, and they can make them into clouds and nebulae and whatnot. And they would play unbelievably fucking great classic rock songs and then make like funny squiggles on the ceiling in the planetarium for an hour. And that was the whole fucking show. So you'd be high as fuck and they'd go, "Welcome to Laserium." And then they'd play Gimme Shelter, not by the Stones, but by the vibraphonist Cal Jader had done a version of Gimme Shelter. So it would go, bong, 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 and then they would play Pink Floyd. Seth controls for the heart of the sun. That was the super trippy slow down. What the fuck is happening to my universe? I think I've devolved into my simian state music. And then they'd play like a super rockin' one, like, carry on my wayward son. You know, like some fucking awful piece of 70s. Don't you cry no more. Yeah. That song has my favorite lyric by any schlocky 70s group. First of all, it was a group called Kansas, which, no. No. The 70s were so full of state and city name bands. Kansas, Boston, there was actually a sub-Boston group called Nantucket, which is beyond the fucking pale. Really, Nantucket? Are you a crustacean-oriented, lobster-based, sort of bisque heavy metal kind of group? And then there was all the southern rock groups, Molly Hatchet and Lynyrd Skynyrd and the Charlie Daniels Band, what they called whiskey rock in those days. Kansas, they had unacceptably long hair and very tight trousers indeed. And in the song Carry On My Wayward Son, one of the lyrics goes, masquerading as a man with a reason, my charade is the event of the season. I'm sorry, Kansas. What social season are you involved in? Are we going to the opera? Are we having cotillion? Really? Kansas has a season? And some long-haired fucking stone Midwestern hippie dude turned to another one and went, man, his charade is simply the event of the season. I don't remember an Oscar Wilde motif to the music of Kansas. And if I claim to be a wise man. Unbelievable. So they would play that, and that was awesome. The Laserium. I don't know if they still do. They still do any kind of weird laser show or anything? Everyone's going to shake their head like this. I know they're having shows in there tonight, but I don't know what they were. I do remember going to one that was a regular planetarium. You know where they go? You know they lower the lights and then they go, this is the movement of the stars in the sky, and then they make all the stars shift and shit, and then they go, this is the winter sky and whatnot. And I remember the guy moved a constellation from one side. This is Orion. You can tell by the belt, and he moves it from one side of the ceiling to the other in the planetarium. And he goes, and look where Orion has went. Now, I don't want to say I was a persnickety 10-year-old or that I was the E.B. White of children, but I was like, has went? Wow. You don't have to be Astro Boy to know that that grammar's all fucked up from Uranus. Nothing has went. That was tremendous good fun to come up here and do that. So we always did. And then you'd go over to the Japanese tea garden when you were super high because they would give you the fabulous tea ceremony with the sweet cookies and whatnot. Yeah. And if you dunk the little Japanese cookies with the almond in the middle of the tea, they go all mushy. Is the Japanese tea garden still here? Okay, that we can agree on. I remember being in the Asian Art Museum when I was in college. I came over to look, and it was, you know, Hindu god and avatar after Hindu god and avatar, right? Like a million bodhisattvas, right? As Steely Dan said, won't you take me by the hand? And thank you, two people my age. Everyone else, what did Beyonce say about it? None of today's performers would mention Hindu gods because they love the Lord. Because the Lord helps them win Grammys and stuff, remember? And the crowd, oh. Did the boring preachy part come early? So there'd be like, you know, Vishnu and who's the blue elephant, Ganesh, and all the myriad incarnations. And I remember being in here with, and there was two tourists who clearly weren't from San Francisco. And the guy had a little, you know, gimme cap on, and he went, "It's all a bunch of fucking gobbledygook to me." And I thought, you're getting it exactly right. That was how it was meant to look to you, like gobbledygook. And I remember coming to see a Jim Henson Muppet Show here. Not a live Muppet Show. It wasn't like Jim Henson was standing, "Hey, everybody.
Hey, ho."
It was, "Hello." It was like the history of Jim Henson, and they had all the puppets. And the big ones from The Dark Crystal, if anyone remembers The Dark Crystal. Yeah. Which is, what? Checky? Oh, is that what they're called, the Skeksis? Now, what were the little, the Skeksis are the, easy with the yelling. It's called the Proopcast, not errant shit from people from Millbrae yelling out fucking willy-nilly. I will call on you if I need you. There was the henchy ones, right, that had the vulture heads. Those are the Skeksis, is it? And then there was the little weird-faced ones with the giant eyes and the mullets. And they were called? The what? The Geltlings? Oh, a Gelfling. Oh, that's clever. And and if you notice, the Gelflings, if you watch Hollywood movies today, a lot of actors and actresses actually look like Gelflings. I don't know if you noticed that. Like Reese Witherspoon or whatever. You know, the giant eyes and the weird blonde hair and the... Oh. And then the giant... there was my favorite Muppet from the first season of Saturday Night Live. No one's going to even fucking believe this because I sound like Father fucking Time. But the first couple of seasons of Saturday Night Live, the Muppets were on. The Muppets were part of the show. And they had a giant Olmec head. You remember the giant Olmec head? And it would go like, "Hey." And that one was, that one always, and Scree, of course, Scree. And Scree talked like this. And he sang a duet with Lily Tomlin, I remember. I think they sang "I Got You, Babe" or something. And then at the end, she went, "I love you, Scree." And she went, and Scree went, "I love you, Lily." So cut two, I'm in Tempe, Arizona, in the 90s, and I go to this dude's house. I met a guy in a band, and he takes me to his friend's house so we can smoke some weed. And the dude has a giant bong, and he goes, I look at the bong, and it's in the shape of one of those like Dark Crystal Muppets, and he goes, "Oh, I see you've met Scree." I'm like, one, I'm happy you have a rich fantasy life, but I'm not going to address your bong by name. I know I'm in a reduced state of dignity here, where I've come over with a bass player from a band I don't even know to smoke weed at your house and look at your shitty art, but I am not going to fucking call your bong Scree, because I have seen Scree at the museum. And your bong, sir, is not Scree. I also remember seeing a Lewis Comfort Tiffany exhibit here where they had all these fabulous lamps and stained glass windows and everything. And again, you know my theory about museums. The way to rob a museum, not this one, but the way to rob a museum is to just grab it and go ass over tea kettle out the fucking door as fast as you can. Because as lovely as the guards are and the docents are and shit, they're not going to fucking catch you. And if I had had the fucking wherewithal when I was 19 years old and the security here was lax as shit and there was no such thing as a fucking camera. There was no security cameras in the 70s and 80s here. I could have a Lewis Comfort Tiffany fucking table lamp right now. In a delightful blue-green, which is my favorite color. Oh, regrets. I've had a few. So it's amazingly exciting. If we can do a Proopcast from the zoo, I'm going to die a happy Proop cat. We also, my wife and I belonged to the zoo when we lived here. And can you belong to a zoo? Of course you can. We were in a pride. And no, I was down with the crows. We were in a murder. And if you're here at the aquarium, you have to roll with a pod. And or a shoal, if you will. They used to let you into the zoo at night. I don't know if they do that anymore. And it was called Wild After Dark. And you're supposed to bring a flashlight with you and shit. And this is all I remember, because the San Francisco Zoo has always had trouble financing, and it, you know, the location, the whole enchilada. And the snack bar would be grilling burgers, and the bears were right across from it. So the bears would just be like, oh, just padding up and down, you know. And you'd be like, hi, buddy. And they're like, oh. And you're like, you know, like in a cartoon, like all of a sudden you have a bun on you and a pickle on your head and two little legs and whatnot, and they're pouring ketchup on you. And I remember we went to the hippo enclosure, and they were letting you feed the hippos, which is an unbelievable fucking breach of any kind of safety. That you had, first of all, there's nothing more, outside of a gigantic alligator or crocodile, nothing is more dangerous to man than a hippopotami, right? Hippopotamus kill more people than a lion could ever fucking dream of killing in a year. And this is how they do it. They knock your boat over if you're in the Zambezi, for instance. Say you're in the Zambezi. No one said it, okay? No one has a sense of humor. I'm in the Zambezi, Greg. No, you're not. You're in the fucking Hearst Forum. But the point is this. If you were in the Zambezi and you're on a little boat, hippos, which they're called river horses, right? They knock your fucking boat over, and then the people who are floating on top, they grab, and then they stomp you into the fucking mud until you're dead. And then they let your body float down the river, and then they have that wry smile, and they wiggle their ears. They wiggle their ears, and their eyes are all crinkly, and they're adorable. They're the most adorable, murderous pachyderms in the entire world. And at the San Francisco Zoo, there used to be the elephants next to the rhinos next to the hippos. Well, elephants are highly intelligent and sensitive, as are hippos. Rhinos, not so much. Rhinos will take you back to the day when there were 10-foot sloths walking around California and 10-foot beavers and shit like that. Yes, there were 10-foot... I'm not talking about Kardashians. I'm talking about there were 10-foot... Oh! Just checking to see if you're awake. There were giant, giant sloths and giant cats all over California. There were camels and horses in California that died out before any white people ever got here, right? And there were enormous ground sloths that were like 10 feet fucking tall. And in those days, rhinoceri, right? That's when the rhinoceri come from, I believe. Like the Epicene, what do they call it? You know, that era. And that's why they had the leathery skin and the thing. And they brought these two over from Burma that I believe Dianne Feinstein and her husband had purchased from the Prince of Tibet. And they were cute as could be. They were little Nepalese rhinos. And they had the little, you know, the little flanges and what them. And apparently they were so fucking stupid. The keeper says to us, they're not interested in people in any way. Right, like elephants, obviously. Elephants and people are like horses and people or dogs and people. People have always ridden elephants. People use them for war. People have always communicated with elephants. Elephants kill people. People kill elephants. You know, we have the same relationship with elephants that we do with all fucking animals. You know, kind of adversarial. I'd eat you, but but you're more useful to pick up these rubber trees and shit like that. So the elephants were just, apparently the rhinos were only interested in the orange bucket because they knew the orange bucket had the fucking, like, you know, turnips in it. And so when the turnips came, the rhinos, and rhinos are dastardly nearsighted, like me, but with a better sense of smell. They, not that I smell better than a rhino, although I aspire to. Rhinos can't see shit. And so, the bucket would come and they'd be like, oh, the bucket. Or whatever primitive rhino thought process they get. Oh, here comes the thing, the two-legged thing with the thing in its hand. I think they use the word thing for everything. Whereas elephants would go, oh, here comes Mary. She smells good. Are those legumes? Because, you know, an elephant's trunk is amazingly sensitive, right? Like the end of your finger or your lips or whatever, it can feel and taste everything. So the rhinos, no. But the elephants would fuck with the rhinos. That's how bored the elephants were. I don't mean literally. Calm down, girls. I mean, the elephants would start to just run up and down like this or stamp their feet, and then the rhinos would go, what the fuck? Something's happening! And start running around in a circle, and then the elephants would just stand and watch them. And that's what they did all day long to entertain themselves. Just mentally mindfuck rhinos all day long. So they're letting us feed the hippopotami. And because it was San Francisco Zoo, it wasn't what you'd think it would be. Like, I don't know, what do hippos eat? Oranges, wrists. It was like Wonder Bread from a bag. So we were throwing Wonder Bread into the hippo's mouth, and they don't like chew after every bite and swallow and then politely floss. They leave their gigantic maw open with the weird tusky teeth that are all green and covered with shit, and you just throw bread in their mouth till the end of fucking time, till their mouth is full of bread, and they're still just like, fill her up, buddy. And then occasionally they close their mouth and then open it again. They haven't swallowed. It's always a car crash, you know. It's like being in the lunchroom with that kid. You know, the kid named Adrian who'd go like that, and you're like, really? I'm trying to fucking eat my sandwich. But what I learned from the hippopotamus, or the hippopotami, or that in the singular hippopotamu that was there, there was a light breeze, as there will be so often about 5 or 6 o'clock out at Sloat Avenue in San Francisco, out near the ocean. The lightly scented eucalyptus breeze blowing by. And the hippo began to urinate. And hippos don't urinate. You know, like, you've all seen a horse urinate, or you've been to an animal show, and the animal that's out there will urinate, and everybody will go, oh, chop, 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 chop. And it's usually an unbelievable gushing fucking stream that you can't get over how much urine is coming out of this animal. And then eventually you're like, okay, stop, thank fuck. Hippos don't urinate like that. They spin their tail, and their urine becomes an enormous circular web. So it's like, and just urine. Like a mister, like an intense spraying mister. And then the breeze caught it, and we all just blah. I've got a piece of urine-soaked fucking Wonder Bread in my hand. My glasses are completely covered with fucking hippo urine. I'm like to my wife, this is wild after dark. It was a fog of urine, of hippo urine. Wow. Wow, indeed. So if you ever are near hippos and you sense that they're about to take a break, move down upwind. Don't stand downwind, or you too will be punished with savory hippo urine, which is difficult to clean. And not nearly as refreshing as you think it might be. Golden Gate Park is amazing. I also lived on the Oberon Page at the very end of it, near where the McDonald's is, the one on Haight. And I may have told this story before on the show, but if I have, please indulge me. When I lived here, when I first moved to San Francisco, that part of the Haight was a no-go fucking zone. There were hippie gay bars. That'll give you an idea of how long ago it was. Gay bars were only dudes with long hair and beards went to meet other dudes with long hair and beards. And every other business had giant bars around the window, and there weren't that many businesses. There was a liquor store and a few other shitty things. There was no such thing as, what is there? There's a Banana Republic and a Gap and every other goddamn thing. None of that. Just bombed out holes and amazingly old head shops. There was one called the White Rabbit, and a lot of really intense fucking characters up and down the street. So the homeless wino dudes used to stand under the shelter at the corner of Stanyan and Haight. And the 72 went from Haight all the way to San Francisco State, where I was matriculating and majoring in marijuana usage. And with a minor in acid. And so we would take the bus from State. The 72 and the 71 went out to State. And I remember seeing two winos in that bus shelter. And here comes a third wino perambulating up. And I only call them winos because that's what they were. This was like 1980. They were, of course, homeless, but they were the three drunk dudes all day. You knew them because they were there at the bus stop all fucking day, right? And they were always drinking. And he goes, I'm going to pretend to drop the bottle, and then you act like I dropped it, and then when he comes up, he'll be all fucking pissed off. I watched them write the scenario. They actually cabaled like an improv group, okay? This is how we're going to do it. And so up comes the next wino, and one guy jumps up, and the other one pretends to drop, and the other guy goes, son of a bitch, and leaps up, and the other one went, what, you fucking dropped it? And then they're like, we fucking got you. And I thought, that was hilarious. This town has such a sense of humor that the winos were fucking with each other. Again, you people are sensitive and stuff. Being homeless is no joke, Greg. Being a dead giraffe from the 19th century is not funny, Greg. I bet you used a paper bag. I bet you asked for a plastic bag today, Greg. It's been a fantastic week. We're going to stay on the positive side this week, he said, until I get to the Republicans. Then, I'm joking, of course. This is the first anniversary, as you know, of the Arab Spring in Egypt. It's been 1 year since Egypt's revolt that started in Tahrir Square. Of course, everything hasn't gone according to plan because, as you know, a budding democracy is a messy, icky, ugly thing. This country took, 8 years to eject the English? And then after that, a lot of white guys with wigs made sure that women and slaves would have no fucking say in the national dialogue for another 140 years. So, you know what it's like when a democracy is first born. It can be rough. But they did have a giant celebration. Hundreds and thousands of people in Tahrir Square, I'm mispronouncing it horribly, Tahrir Square. In the capital, some Egyptians celebrated as they gathered at the traffic circle, whose name has become synonymous with global pro-democracy movement. Most, though, appeared to be there to mourn and protest military rule. The generals assumed control immediately after Mubarak fell, 18 days into the revolt, and Egypt has traveled an uncertain and troubled path since then. Don't you love journalism? An uncertain and troubled path. That means the army kills people. That's what uncertain and troubled mean in news talk, like detainees. 1,000 people have died in the last year since the revolution at the hands of, and I love what they call them, security forces. Now, if they were making you secure, they wouldn't be killing you. You would feel more secure, like, hey, you've got a gun, you're going to protect, oh. I don't feel as secure as I once did. Mr. Security Force. In any case, according to this article, which is from the Washington Post, because as you know, the Chronicle only keeps two or three reporters on the payroll. Mick LaSalle and Henry Schulman, I think, and everyone else. For 30 years we waited for change and it never came, said Ahmed Abdel Naguib, who read a sign on his back, candidate for martyrdom. You catch the irony there. The protesters did not necessarily represent a majority view. According to a recent Gallup poll, and you know what? When I look for accuracy, when I want a quorum of opinion from the people of Egypt, I go to the Gallup people. Because next to Anderson Cooper, I don't think there's a more reliable source. They took a Gallup poll of Egyptians, apparently. 82% of Egyptians believe that... Now, mind you, how many people live in Egypt? Like, 80 million, is it? Yeah. Do you really think they polled all 80 million, or do they poll, like, oh, I don't know, 80, and then extrapolate from there? And only the ones that speak English. And only the ones who know what the fucking Gallup poll is. And only ones who like Americans. And only the ones who wanted to answer the fucking question. And only the ones who didn't have big noses. And only the ones who weren't scary and wearing a dishdash. And only the ones who, in any case... Just giving you an idea how numbers can be skewed any which way you want them to go. According to a recent Gallup poll, 82% of Egyptians believe the military will hand over power to a civilian government as promised. Well, that's terrific. We're trying for a note of optimism there, but I can't help but be cynical when I read things like that. In any case, good for Egypt, and God bless them for having an entire year... without Hosni Mubarak. In Scotland, and I don't know if you read, this was in the San Francisco Chronicle today, right over the donate your car. And apparently there's a truckload sale at Airport Home Appliance. And for some reason, there's a woman standing there with her arms crossed, beaming fiendishly. Because as you know, no man would want to buy an appliance. Just like on TV, no man cleans a kitchen with a mop. This crowd has gone so quiet. We're in San Francisco. I thought you would understand what I was talking about. When you watch TV, there'll be an ad and there'll be a woman like scrubbing the toilet or whatever, or scrubbing up the kitchen, and then she'll look at the thing she's scrubbing with and go, yeah. Like, there's nothing more fulfilling for women than to clean. But you never see a fucking man scrubbing a thing and then go, fuck yeah. This Swiffer is everything I fucking need. So we're selling appliances here, refrigerators, ranges and whatnot, a Bosch stainless steel dishwasher, which looks nice. But it's a woman grinning fiendishly. Because obviously, if it was a man, another man would be inside him. So on the opposite side of that page was this article about, and the headline is, Great Britain. Scottish leader urges a clean break. Scotland's leader has presented, the First Minister of Scotland, his name is Alex Salmond, S-A-L-M-O-N-D, not salmon, has, although the salmon in Scotland are fantastic and fiercely independent. If you hook a Scottish salmon, it'll be like, don't you fucking smoke me. Do not put me on a piece of fucking bread with cream cheese. I will fuck you up, you DOS fucking fucker. Scotland's leader has presented his proposal for a ballot on independence, and his ideas include letting 16 and 17-year-olds cast ballots in a vote. And when was the last time you heard that idea floated in this country, that 16 and 17-year-olds should cast ballots? We can't even let people who are allowed to join the army and die vote. I mean, or drink, rather, right? Suddenly I turned into Herman. Who was it, Herman Cain? Or was it Rick Perry? You got to be 21 to vote in this country. Well, not for a while, but okay. You can join the army, and you can go serve, and you can have your eye blown out, and then you can come back and live the rest of your life in everlasting fucking agony. But you can't have a fucking beer, because, you know, first things first, and the Lord and shit like that. First Minister Alex Salmond announced the Scottish government's preferred options for a vote on whether to sever ties from Britain. As you know, Great Britain, or maybe you don't know, so I shall explain, since apparently you didn't know that women's only pleasure in life was to clean fucking kitchens. Great Britain is several nations, four in fact. It is England, Wales, Scottish land, and Northern Ireland, right? And then the other part of Ireland is the Republic of Ireland, and they are not part of Great Britain. However, you'll notice they are attached to Great Britain because the English have the northern part, which would be the Protestant, or largely Protestant. Of course, they live everywhere amongst one another. Or as one informed person asked me years ago here, how come the Protestants don't just have a separate part? In any case, they are four nations bound together, and that's why they are Great Britain, and not just England. And because they invented the game of soccer, or as we like to call it, the footy, when the World Cup comes around, because they invented it, they send four fucking teams. And then you wonder why England never goes to the last round of the World Cup in football. And it's because there's a team from Wales, a team from Scotland, a team from Northern Ireland, and a team from England. Now, if they pooled all their resources and were Britain, they would have a fuck-off kick-ass team. But instead, no, there's a fucking Welsh team that gets knocked out in the first round by fucking Belarus. In any case, they want to be independent from the rest of England. Scotland and England united in 1707 to form Great Britain. Scotland gained significant autonomy after voting in 1997 to set up the Edinburgh-based Scottish Parliament. But some Scots want to go further and make the nation of 5 million people an independent country within the European Union. Now, you realize what that would mean, right? All of a sudden, you're a legal entity, you're a sovereign nation. Now, you're attached completely physically to England because you can drive straight through. Now, when you go to Scotland, English people in England, they have coins for their pounds, right? Coins. In Scotland, they still had notes, dollars of a pound. And if you tried to negotiate a fucking Scottish pound note in London, they look at you like, are you fucking kidding me? I am not taking that fucking Scottish money, even though it's from... It would be like if you took money from San Francisco and tried to negotiate it in LA, and they went, we're not taking that Northern California shit. That's how far Edinburgh is from London. And they were like, no. He told Scottish lawmakers in Edinburgh and the Assembly on Wednesday, and they have a beautiful Parliament building there. Do you agree that Scotland? Do you agree that Scotland should be an independent country? And he said the voting age should be lowered from the current 18. If a 16-year-old in Scotland can register to join the army, and they can in Scotland, get married and pay taxes, surely he or she should be able to have a say in this country's constitutional future. Scottish 16-year-olds can join the army, though they cannot be sent into combat until they are 18. Well, that seems humane. Work full-time and marry without parental consent. The official Scottish drinking age outside the home is 18. Let me hip you to something. The official Scottish drinking age anywhere, home or not, is about 11. But that has some exceptions for 16 and 17-year-olds. They drink real early there, and they have kids. You meet people in England who are like, 14 that have five kids and have a drinking problem. It's awesome. What time are we at, Daniel?
It is 7:55.
Right. I know what time it is. How long have we gone?
Oh, you've gone 50 minutes?
50? Okay, thank you. Wow, I see people are leaving. Apparently, they're desperate to get over to that otter enclosure. Well, to lift your spirits a little bit, let's talk about Mitt Romney's tax returns. There's a picture of Mitt Romney standing here in front of a giant poster that says, "Obama isn't working." Well, one, he is. I think you mean his policies aren't working. Clearly, Obama is working. I saw him on TV two nights ago giving a speech. I think you'll find he is in the office most days. I'll tell you someone who hasn't had a job in government for a long time, and that would be Mitt fucking Romney. Because it says here at the end, the lion's share of Romney's income is derived from investments because he hasn't worked in years. The money he makes all comes from what he'd made before. So if anybody isn't working, it's Mitt fucking Romney. Unless you consider a job running around the country acting like a game show host and hoping Newt Gingrich doesn't crawl up your ass like an armadillo. I don't begrudge anyone making the money that they earn. That we live in a capitalist society and there's no bloody way around it. We all need money. Mitt Romney reported, this is from the McClatchy newspapers. Again, the Chronicle didn't send a reporter out on this one. Mitt Romney reported owing $6.2 million in federal taxes on $42.5 million in income over the last 2 years that he just released. 500 pages of documents. He hasn't filed his 2011 return yet. None of us have. The former Massachusetts governor, that means he's not working right now, made an estimated $20.9 million last year. And he expected to pay $3.2 million in taxes. That's 15.4%. Now, $3.2 million is a lot of fucking taxes. In fact, I'm going to guess that everyone in this room hasn't made $3.2 million in all of our lifetimes together. 15.4 is the rate he pays. He had offshore accounts in the Caymans, a blind trust, a Swiss bank account until 2010. He's worth net $190 million to $250 million. Romney's tax returns contrast with that of his chief rival. And by the way, he's only the chief rival because the media says he's the chief rival. If Newt Gingrich wins any other states, I will be a bob-tailed albino fucking crocodile. Newt's only worth, he reported $3.16 million. After deductions, Gingrich family had an effective tax rate of 31%. Well done, Gingrich. By contrast, Mitt and Ann Romney reported income above $20 million in 2010. They paid $3 million in taxes. They donated almost $3 million to charity. Now, mind you, a lion's share of that went to the Mormon Church. That's a charity as well. The numbers were bigger than I expected. Most people pay, and this is what I wanted to get to, ordinary income from wages can be taxed as high as 35%. For instance, if you make, $40,000 a year, you get taxed at that rate, whereas the person who made $20 million gets a 15% tax rate. That's all I wanted to say, and On the other hand, says the guy from the Brookings Institution, which is no liberal namby-pamby institution, his income from working still seems pretty big. Give me $20 million and see what I do besides buy a giant chunk of Humboldt County. So to lift our spirits to the sky, Harry Belafonte has a movie that's on TV called Sing Your Song, right? He made it. There's a documentary about him, which focuses on his activism. Now, for those of you who don't know who Harry Belafonte was, no, he wasn't at the San Francisco Zoo fucking with rhinos. He is a singer, an activist. He's from, where is he from? Does anyone know which island? He's from the Caribbean, I know that. He's not from the Bahamas, that's Sidney Poitier. Jamaica, he's from Jamaica. In the 1950s, we did not have a lot of black stars in this country till rock and roll came out. Harry Belafonte was one of the first great black sex symbols for white women in this country, because he would come on TV in tight white pants and sing the Banana Boat song, and white women would be like, this is all right. My husband has a crew cut and weird shop teacher glasses. I have to drive a Studebaker to the store and pretend I enjoy cleaning all fucking day long, and then make cheese dip for a bunch of douchebag alcoholic assholes who smoke up my fucking house. Meanwhile on TV, Dale, I'm upside down, my head is turning around because I left a little girl in Kingston Town. He had a beautiful rough voice. He's gorgeous still at 84. They're talking about Martin Luther King. He's been a civil rights activist for a million years. You may remember during the Bush administration, I can't say the word because it's too egregious, he was the one who said Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell were the, let's put it this way, house servants, except he didn't use the word servant. And the crowd goes quiet again. But Greg, using racial epithets and pejoratives is bad. It's like a dead baby giraffe. Oh, dead baby giraffe. Carry on, dead baby giraffe. Don't you cry no more. No. My giraffe is the giraffe of the season. He knew Dr. King quite well, and if you don't know who Dr. King is, fucking switch over to another fucking podcast. I don't have time to explain every goddamn moment of American history to you fucking fascists. To me, he expressed his great concern about the integration movement, and he made the point that he had come to a moment in his own sense of history that, in fact, we were integrating into a burning house. This is 1968, when, as I've pointed out many times in this show, we had a revolution in this country, right? Black against white, rich against poor, young against old. Vietnam War was going. There were riots all over the fucking country. And then we had the Democratic Convention in Chicago in 68, and there were mad riots there, too. People were thrown into jail. People were tried. The Chicago 7. You can look it all up. Try to look for the truth. Try to read a book that has some fucking truth in it. Don't read a Lynn Cheney history book. In any case, he said, when I said to him, you say we're integrating him into a burning house, what are you expecting of us? What should we be doing? And Martin Luther King said, become firemen. Yeah. Do you think he would have been pleased with the progress made between then and 2012? Now, we know what that question means, because we've all studied enough journalism to know what that means. We have a black president now, one raised by white women. And that's an important thing in this country, because we're all mixed. Let's get down to it. And he says, I think we're witnessing is the end of an empire. I think America reigned for a couple of hundred years, but in the mistake it has just made, has planted the seeds for its own destruction. I think that although the nation won't go away, systems will have to change. By the mistake, you mean the Iraq War. You once referred to George W. Bush as the greatest terrorist in the world. And his answer is not so much the system is collapsing, it's just the fact that men of ill will have done greedy things. But I think it's also the fact that people who enjoy the position of power try to keep it at any cost. I don't know how many times I've reiterated that on this show, because I'm always trying to get it through people's heads That's what's going on all the time. It's not that the world doesn't want to change. When you see 500,000 people on the street in Egypt, the world fucking wants to change. It's just that there are men of ill will. And what about women of ill will? There are men of ill will. Women of ill will do not run everything in the goddamn world. And that they have done greedy things, right? And they will who enjoy the position of power, try to keep it at any cost. The fact that people who enjoy the position of power try to keep it at any cost. The fact that people who enjoy that position of power try to keep it at any cost. Now, do you understand what I'm saying? You've repeated it 4 times. How are we supposed to understand it? Because when you see a bunch of people protesting and a policeman comes up and pepper sprays them, that's the people in power trying to keep power at any cost. When they spray teenagers on the campus of UC Davis, when they spray blue-collar workers who are in an encampment trying to get their point across that they're not getting their fair share, that we are being taxed at giant exorbitant rates, that the rich are being taxed at little tiny rates because of capital gains and what like that, that there's wars going all over the world. Obama started the fucking State of the Union address by saying, our military presence around the world and our victories have made us safer and more respected. Does anyone believe that? Outside of the fucking Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Pentagon who had to go like this. No, it hasn't made us safer, and no, it hasn't made us more respected. Do you think there's a country in the world that goes, fucking, I love it that America kicks ass. I wish they'd kick ass on us so that we could enjoy freedom too. So that's the story. They want to keep the system the way it is and have the world adjust to the system, not the system to the world. And that just isn't going to happen. And that's the part that gives me hope. Herb Alafani's 84 years old. He's been through a lot. He's seen a lot. He's from the Caribbean, which, as you know, is a dastardly third world place, utterly corrupted by people, men, greedy men of ill will and power. And he feels like the system can't be the same, that it is going to change, that it is changing. And it fucking is. It's just that they're going to hold on kicking and screaming until the very last minute. And if you don't believe me, let me go back just a little bit in time. Let's go back to the 70s when there were no black men elected president, when Shirley Chisholm was the last, you know, was running for president, a black woman. And then in the 80s when Jesse Jackson ran, and they're like, oh, Jesse Jackson, he got let's go back even a short time, 1920. That's when women, every woman in this room, couldn't vote in 1919 because men of ill will, greedy men of ill will, did not want you to fucking vote. But why? Why wouldn't they want women to vote? Because they didn't want women to have a fucking voice. They wanted women to stay right next to this appliance here and smile at it all night long. So never listen to them and never listen to their bullshit. Only listen to Harry Belafonte. In the film, you call yourself an optimist. Optimism is a key component of survival, and I've got to believe that all we've done, that all the people have died for, is not only in vain, but when I look at Occupy Wall Street and see what's going on in the Middle East, people rising against oppressive regimes, it's a very, very promising sign that people are in motion. I think we're going to make it. And then, awesomely, you recorded the Banana Boat song. It's the last question. A half century later, you can't go to a sporting event without Dale. Do you get royalties? And he laughs. I'm still somewhat puzzled with that song. That's become a rallying cry for sports teams in America. But no, I don't get royalties. Because that one note and that one word, albeit hyphenated, all comes in under the edge of the law that protects me copyright-wise. It's public domain yell. But I'd rather have it that way than not have it at all. So right on, Harry Belafonte. If we're talking about people you can get into and get behind and respect, that's what I'm talking about. I don't think Mitt Romney is an evil fucker who walks the earth and rises at night and wants to eat the flesh of humans and shit like that. I don't even think Newt Gingrich probably hates all of his ex-wives or whatever and stomps on kittens and shit. I'm sure there's been a moment Newt Gingrich went, or Gingrich, or however the fuck you say his name, ooh, these cinnamon cookies are delightful. I'm going to dunk one in milk. Look, a kitty. You know, before he fed a mouse to the python that he keeps in his fucking jar outside his house. I'm sure there's nice moments. I'm sure Dick Cheney every once in a while goes, huh, huh, yeah, huh. Look over there. Flowers. Look at those flowers. Boy, those are growing out of the ground of their own free will. I mean, he has a family, right? So he's been inside a woman. I'm trying to look at the positive side on Dick Cheney. You know what I'm talking about. When you see the Silvio Berlusconis of the world and the Hosni Mubaraks of the world, and I hate when people pluralize singulars. When you see Hosni Mubarak, when you see Silvio Berlusconi, when you see David Cameron, when you see George W. Bush, when you see Cheney, they are people, after all. Hitler was a person. Stalin wrote poetry. Mao probably got up in the morning sometimes and went, look, a dog. I don't know why he talked like Christopher Walken, but... dog. I like to pet it. Or make soup. I'm just talking about people you can admire. You know what I mean? I can admire Harry Belafonte because, first of all, he was a superb singer. He's a tremendous actor. And he's an activist who cares about people. Newt Gingrich. Gingrich. Hard to admire someone who calls Obama the food stamp president over and over again. Food stamp is code, and we all know what that code means. I'm not even going to go into my usual long-ass explanation where I say the same thing 15 times. If I call you a food stamp person, you get where I'm coming from on that? If I call you an egg roll person, do you understand what I'm talking about? If you call me a fucking bohunk hee-haw, hay bale truck driving person, do I understand what you're talking about? Yeah. I think we all fucking speak code in this country. It's just that we speak in code and we're never honest with each other. If once at one of these giant fucking rallies where everybody cheers the death penalty and cheers when people die on Medicare or whatever, the kind of shit they cheer out at these things, if once one of the candidates got up and went, I don't like Obama because he's black. And it really rubs me the fucking wrong way to have a black president. That would be the moment everybody would go, oh my God, I can't believe he said that. And then, fuck, that's the truth. You guys can be as quiet as you fucking like. Let's go on our questions here. SmartestOfTheSpecialThing.com. Also, by the by, we're broadcasting Saturday here at the Punchline. We're back in Los Angeles in February. Go to proofcast.com. All the dates are there. You can download the show for free any bloody time you like. And like that. We're also going to be in London on March 27th. We're going to be in Paris, awesomely, at La Java on April 3rd. We've got a bunch of other dates coming up. We're going to be in Raleigh, North Carolina. We're going to be in Nashville, Tennessee to go visit our friends there. So there'll be Proofcasts in all those towns. And, of course, as always, you can download it for free. If you want to query us, Pocus Protus, or send me a question, it's smartest@aspecialthing.com. I don't read these beforehand, but I'm going to read one here. And then do we have time to take a couple questions? I think we do. Are there people? People are fucking off as quickly as they can. I'll do one question, and then we'll take some from the audience. How's that grab you? Dear Lord of the Kitten, Natty asks, Dear Lord of the Kittens, yes, my kitten princess, or kitten prince, if you're a man, who are the top five women who stand for, I don't fucking read these. This just happens to be here. Who are the top five women who stand for equality of rights around the world? Shit. Well, I think the woman on the Chronicle page here who's smiling next to that refrigerator, striking a fucking blow for freedom, she couldn't be more excited about that fucking range. Off the top of my head, well, the women who won the Nobel Prize this year, one woman was named Ellen Sirleaf Johnson. The other one whose name is extraordinarily difficult to pronounce, Lema Gbowee, they were both from Liberia, which has been, as you know, a war-torn and revolutionary-prone country the last few years. I would say them, because they were fighting against rape and slaughter. The woman from There was also a woman from the Yemen whose name escapes me. She also won the Nobel Prize. She, I think, is one of the top five. Just going from the Bay Area here, I remember a woman very clearly named Dolores Huerta, who helped start the United Farm Workers with Cesar Chavez. She's still alive and still runs. Yeah, right on. A very beautiful Latino lady who was beaten brutally by the SFPD in the 80s. I would also say Hillary Clinton, because, but she's a politician in the machine just like everyone else. I know, but Hillary Clinton always talks about women's reproductive rights. She talks about gay rights, and she talks about women's rights all the time, much more than the president does. And also, I don't know if you listen to a show called Democracy Now. Amy Goodman, I think, is a woman who is an extraordinarily admirable person with a hilarious delivery.
This is Amy Goodman from Democracy Now, the War and Peace Report. We're here in Tahrir Square talking about the Arab Republic.
Does anyone want to ask any questions? Because I won't force you into it. Where's the microphone? Does anyone work in the mic here? Who's on the mic? Who are you, baby?
Just a baby.
What's your name?
My name's Heather.
Oh, hi, Heather. How are you?
Hi, Greg.
Oh, I know who you are. This young man has a question here, Heather. What's your name, sir?
My name's Lee, Excellency.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you tonight?
I'm very well, thank you.
On the eve of what may be the first of many films based on a Janet Ivanovich book, which Stephanie Plum book would you ensure doesn't make it into a film, and who would you cast as Stephanie Plum for the rest of the adaptations?
Right. How did you know that I read the Janet Ivanovich books?
You have said it on a podcast.
Did I mention that?
Yes,
oh,
you did.
Oh, my goodness. What do they call that on TV? A guilty pleasure? You're not supposed to mention as a man that you read the Stephanie Plum novels. One, they're point-to-point prose, like Louis L'Amour or whatever. Stephanie got in the car. Stephanie shot the gun. The car blew up. It's not exactly the most challenging literature of all time. Jane Austen, it is not. They are great fun, the Stephanie Plum novels. And Janet Ivanovich, good for her. I think she's up to 17 or 18 of them now. And a few little extra ones. There's Plum Spooky and stuff like that. I wouldn't have cast Katherine Hagel, although I haven't seen the movie yet, so I've got to give her a chance. First of all, I see Katherine Hagel as a blonde. And Stephanie Plum is supposed to be, what, about a 5'9" brunette girl, real Jersey type, you know. They're very funny. My favorite scene in one of the books is she's a bounty hunter, right? And some shit goes down. She's always having cars blown up. She comes out of her building with her gun, and because she lives in New Jersey, every single person in the apartment building comes out of their door with a gun. And that fucking made me laugh. I've been thinking about it, and I've been wondering about who it should be. And it should be a Leah Remini type, but she should be taller. She should be the stature of Jennifer Garner, but have the voice of Leah Remini. So if they clone the two of them and put them together and put Jennifer Garner's body with Leah Remini's head on it. I need to think of an actress who can do that. That's a very good question. I can't give you one off the top of my head. But I'm going to give Katherine Hagel a chance, although her expression on the poster is not beguiling me to see the movie. And I have no idea who plays Grandmama's. Do you read them too? I take it you do, since you and I are having a geek attack here.
I read the first couple. And
you read the first couple. Yeah. Bull fucking shit. Don't ever fucking lie to me. You're up to like Heaven 17 or whatever, man. Who do you think should play it? Stephanie, I mean.
Well, I was thinking Leah Remini as well, too.
Who?
Leah Remini.
Oh, Leah Remini. Yeah, well, because she's supposed to be, you know, she goes to her parents' house every Sunday for pot roast, and then she has sex with her boyfriend, who's this hot cop guy, and then her car gets blown up by gangsters. This is the plot of every book. Like any great series of books, there is no deviation in the plot, like Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes at the end doesn't go, fuck, Watson, you were right. And Stephanie Plum doesn't go, oh, my car didn't blow up. She fucking gives her hamster some cereal, and then her car gets blown up, and then that's how every book goes. All right, thank you for that question. Anyone else, or is that it? It's, oh, okay. There's someone behind you there, that lady. Hello, ma'am.
Hi. What was your first comedy gig, and was it here in San Francisco?
Did you say it's my first comedy gig?
Yes.
And was it in San Francisco? No. I'm from San Carlos. My first comedy gig was at the College of San Mateo with my partner, Forrest Brakeman. Yeah. Harvard on the Hill, the knob of knowledge. And I think it was probably a lunchtime gig. I talked about it in the last one, but I don't think the podcast has come out yet. There was a band there at one of the lunchtime gigs, and they invited us to go work with them at the winery in Palo Alto and do sets in between their sets. And I said that was what started me off on stand-up comedy, because they let us drink and act like adults. And that was what seduced me into being a stand-up comedian. One, the freedom of being able to say what you want, but two, being treated like a grown-up. As a teenager, I was, you know, disgruntled. And I wanted to be treated like an adult. And that's always been really important to me. I've never understood people who get into their 20s and 30s and want to act like they're 18. I always wanted to act older than I was, because when you were older, you got respect and you got to make decisions and shit happened, as opposed to when you're 18 and you're like a, you know. So I was probably about 18. I mean, I did, you know, stand up in high school and shit. We used to, like, memorize, like, Who's on First by Abbott and Costello, and do it at the talent show and shit like that. And we did an early Gallagher one. I remember we did a Sledge-O-Matic routine with a hammer and used to beat fruit on stage and whatnot. But that was when I was a kid. But I think the first paid gig was probably College Cemetery. I know that's a riveting answer.
I think we have time for one more.
All right, Heather. And don't ever, ever fucking tell me what to do again, Heather. I invite you to rent a condo that's off my dick. Joking. Do we have one more? Or did I scare everyone off? Here's someone in the front.
Hi, Greg.
Hi, what's your name?
Ken?
Ken. Hi, Ken.
You made reference to Tom Lehrer, I think a couple of troop casts ago.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you can share your thoughts about Tom Lehrer as a comedian, musician, maybe as a social critic.
Tom Lehrer. A lot of people don't remember Tom Lehrer. Tom Lehrer, I think, lives in... Does he still live in Santa Cruz? I think he moved back to the East Coast. I know he taught at Santa Cruz for a while. He was an excellent mathematician. Yeah. Tom Lehrer did comedy albums in the late 50s and early 60s. That's his prime time. Although I think he did a song for an electric company called Sesame Street Silent E was one of his last ones. He had a high-pitched whiny voice, and he wore glasses. And yeah. Oh no, he's on my tip, man. I love it. And he did the most horrible patter in between. He did funny songs, but not parodies of songs. Unlike, as you know, the Capitol Steps, who I detest with every fiber of my being. Tom Lehrer's songs were actually hilarious, and they were on all the topical things. There was a show called That Was the Week That Was, and he did a lot of the topical songs on that show, as well as his own albums. And his albums were called things like An Evening Wasted with Tom Lehrer. That was one of his live albums. And he did something that I used to copy in the 90s when I would play England. On the back of the albums were only bad reviews. You know how everybody puts stunning, an achievement in comedy or whatever? His would be my favorite one, more desperate than amusing. And the other one was vulgarity. He put bad reviews on his albums. And then it would be, and he'd write his own liner notes. Tom lives with his parrot, what was it, and his mother, and his memories. And what memories those must be. He did a song called Oedipus Rex, because there was a 50s art film called Oedipus Rex. And he goes, I determined that the reason why this song was not, this movie was not a financial box office sensation was the lack of a catchy theme song. So the song goes, Oedipus Rex was a man with a strange complex. His name is listed in Freud's index because he loved his mother. And then at the end, so meet mother every now and then and have a chat and give her candy or flowers and a brand new hat. But maybe you had better let it go at that. One of his best ones is Poisoning Pigeons in the Park. Spring is here, life is Skittles and life is beer. And then he go, so each Sunday, come be with my sweetheart and me as we poison the pigeon in the park. And maybe we'll do in a squirrel or two as we poison the pigeon in the park. We'll slaughter them all amongst laughter and merriment, except for the few we take home to experiment. My pulse will be quickening with each drop of strychnine as we poison the pigeon. So that was the kind of songs he did. The topical ones were really good. The Vatican Rag, I remember, was one that was supposed to be the Pope's new hip theme song. First you get down on your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head in great respect, and genuflect. And then he recorded an album in San Francisco, Live at the Hungry Eye, and it had a song called Pollution on it. And it was the stuff they eat for lunch in San Francisco. What was it? The stuff they eat for breakfast across the bay, they drink for lunch in San Jose, I think was one of the lines. I think he was really pointed, and I think he was marvelous, and I think he was dead clever. And I read an interview with him in a very good book Gerald Nachman wrote called Seriously Funny about all the rebel comedians of the 50s and 60s. And Tom Lehrer said he didn't like the swearing from now. That's what he really didn't appreciate, which is always a stance that I'm like, whatever, Lenny Bruce fucking swore and he was fucking funny. But Tom Lehrer would say just the most dastardly jokes in between the songs. He'd go, I had a friend who majored in animal husbandry until they caught him at it. And then what was the other one? I knew a man who became a doctor who specialized in diseases of the very rich. Yeah. Maybe it's not as current as I thought it was. I believe they did a musical of him in the 80s called Tomfoolery, did they not? Where they put all the songs together and had other people singing them. But you have to listen to him singing because he has, it would say, his playing, his piano, and his, quote, so-called voice on the album cover. I think he's marvelous, and I think he's still alive, and I think it's time to revisit Tom Lehrer because he was nasty and vicious and wicked and mean. I think there's a paucity of that. In musical comedy. I love Weird Al, but Weird Al never fucking said, I hold your hand in mine, dear. I press it to my lips. I take a healthy bite from your dainty fingertips. Until they come and get me. Yeah. It's impossible to describe. I just realized that. I've sung 1,000 illustrative lyrics, and this crowd is still like, that sounds gross. Like a dead baby giraffe. Thank you for your question. I think we've got to pull out here because we have a comedy group coming in afterward. I'd like to end on a high note, but I don't see how that's going to happen this week. All right, one last question off the list here, and then we'll fucking go. Because I'd like... Can you see me struggling for an ending here? It's not that I don't have the confidence to end on a quiet note. It's just that there's so many bloody people in here, and I'm so chuffed to be at the Academy of Sciences that I really wanted everyone to laugh as I closed the show, as opposed to, ha, ha, ha. Alan asks, Mr. Proops. Yes, Alan? Which song by the band Cheap Trick is your... Oh, yeah. Where do I fucking begin? There's so many songs by Cheap Trick. They're so fucking awesome. I've said it before on the show. They're the most underrated rock band in the world next to the Suite. They have the best lead singer. They have a great lead guitar player. I saw them in 1977 open for Kiss, and they played L.O. Kitties to open, and it was so fucking loud that I was pinned to the floor of the Cow Palace. And then they opened with, we're Cheap Trick. Can you hear us out there? I don't think there's any song better than If You Want My Love, You Got It, because it's just so fucking from the heart. And also... Robin can sing like John Lennon, which is very spooky and awesome. I think I'd have to say Surrender. Because, wow, is that a good fucking song. And talk about not rhyming in the first stanza. Mother told me, yes, she told me I'd meet girls like you. She also told me stay away. You never know what you'll catch. Mommy's all right, daddy's all right. They just seem a little weird. Surrender, surrender, but don't give yourself away. It proves you don't have to rhyme any fucking lines in a song as long as it fucking rocks as hard as humanly possible. And on that note, I will say thank you very much for coming out here tonight, ladies and gentlemen. You are beloved. This is the I wish you nothing but whale skeletons and tiny stuffed giraffes.